Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for graduation and Father's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA.
It did not take Pew Research long to poll about 1,000 Americans on the National Security Agency's telephone tracking program. It found that 56% of Americans say the NSA program is an acceptable way for the government to investigate terrorism. But a substantial minority, 41%, call it unacceptable. The Pew Research Center reports the American public is more evenly divided on government surveillance of email and online activities than on the telephone records. Pew conducted the poll June 6th through the 9th and questioned 1,004 adults. We welcome you to Current State here for Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up, the Michigan Environmental Council's Tim Fisher on all the important transportation issues facing the state and where MEC stands on those. Also, Chad Gamble, the City of Lansing's Director of Public Service, on an idea to combine various repair initiatives to the city's infrastructure, specifically sewers. It's called the Wet Weather Project. Right now, Michigan's state legislative districts are redrawn after every U.S. census. The last time around, in 2011, the process turned contentious and led many Democrats to allege gerrymandering by the GOP majority. They point to what they say are contorted district lines drawn to ensure a political advantage. Now, some state lawmakers are formally calling for a change. Democratic State Representative Sean McCann of Kalamazoo and his allies have introduced a plan they say would eliminate gerrymandered districts and, quote, take politics out of the process, unquote. We want to point out that Current State contacted both the state Republican Party headquarters and Republican State Representative Pete Lund about joining us for this segment to offer their perspective. Representative Lund played a significant role in the redistricting process last time as chairman of the House Elections and Redistricting Committee. Those efforts were not successful. We welcome State Representative Sean McCann to Current State. Hi, Sean.
Hi, good morning, Mark. Nice to be with you.
Sure, same here. Many Democrats complained loudly over redistricting that happened most recently in 2011. In your view, what's wrong with the way these districts were redrawn?
Well, the first thing I would point out is that, it's Michigan and it's Democrats and Republicans with Democrats in the minority, but other states may have that reversed, and I think the process is poor for either party to be using, and that's the point for the nonpartisan idea. But a lot of maps were drawn after the last census. Some of them are very egregious offenders. I know we're on radio, but I tell you what, when folks see some of these maps that I show them, they get it, and it's really obvious. But there's also a subtle piece to it, which is that the whole process is designed to ensure that one party keeps a majority in a legislative chamber. So some people may point to districts that aren't so wildly drawn or aren't so slanted in favor of one party office holder or the other, but make no mistake that at the end of the day, it's designed to keep a 56 majority in a chamber of 110 people.
I took a look at the way House District 76 near Grand Rapids was redrawn in 2011 yesterday, and it resembles nothing I've ever seen in nature. It was really quite an eye opener. Is that the best example of gerrymandering in your opinion?
It's definitely one of the winners. There's also one that's currently represented by U.S. Congressman Gary Peters that starts up in Pontiac and winds through Detroit and ends up in the Grosse Pointe, and it's kind of almost like a double C with or facing one sea facing the other direction. So it's but Grand Rapids, particularly the current representative, told me that people trying to figure out whose district they lived in at some points along the way, where the connection between like a couple of larger land masses is so narrow, it's a couple of blocks, and then it, you know, reconnects to a larger section. So it's just, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words, and it's definitely the case with these kind of maps.
And when this topic comes up with anyone who resists the idea, what do they tend to say? How is this practice defended?
Well, I think it, I'm not really sure, actually, how it's defended. I don't think it's too defensible. I guess some folks say that this is what elected officials should be doing, is drawing the maps. It's called for in the Constitution, so I guess that would mean that there's no better ideas out there under the sun. It's really, quite frankly, hard to come up with good reasons, and I haven't heard too many why a nonpartisan process is not better. And certainly from constituents, that's really what drove this whole passion for me, was not only serving in the Kalamazoo City Commission for a decade, but as I spent time in the legislature, more and more of my conversations with everyday citizens were talking about this frustration, and I rooted it back to this issue, among other things. But this I think is one of the core issues, that's at that frustration with gridlock, it's at that frustration with not having the voices be heard, at that frustration with a lack of compromise.
Your measure would establish a nonpartisan citizen commission whose responsibility would be to draw the maps, as I understand it. Who would serve on that commission, and how would they be chosen?
Well, it's an interesting process. How can you get to nonpartisanship or bipartisanship? Because there
yes,
would
it
be,
is.
there would be Democrats and Republicans involved, but there's also a call for a portion of people to not have had any clear political affiliations, which is not to say that, you know, people don't have ideological perspectives, but you can't have been a party officer, you can't have given money to a candidate. There's some really clear filters that prohibit certain people from being able to be a part of this process. And then the other component that's really, I think, a great component of this system would be that the legislative leaders of the chambers, so let's say the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader in the House and the Senate, they each get to kick out some of the members that apply that they don't like. So as this process goes along and people are sort of filtered out, it's sort of like when a jury is being selected and the prosecution gets to pick some people out that they don't like, who they think might be too favorable to the other side, and the defense gets to do the same thing. It's a jury strike, and that's the kind of key component built into this, as well as just filtering down, having random drawings. It's really a good way to get to, I think, you know, a set of folks that are probably pretty darn reasonable and willing to compromise.
We're talking with Democratic State Representative Sean McCann of Kalamazoo about his plan to eliminate what he alleges are gerrymandered districts here in the state legislative map. Seriously, though, Sean, have you what do members of the GOP say when this topic comes up? Have you had conversations with Republicans about this? What's the sampling of opinions you're hearing?
Well, I haven't actually heard a lot, really, from I think either side at this point. It's just been introduced. I did hear one representative comment that that the maps were fair and that they were drawn with the knowledge that seats were going to be lost by the Republican Party in the legislature. But again, I hearken back to the notion that while seats may get sacrificed for the greater good, the majority is what's supposed to be maintained. So it's really just been positive feedback from everyday citizens. I've literally gotten unsolicited emails from people in Grand Rapids and Battle Creek and Flint and Saginaw just saying hooray, and this is what we really need. So I think my guess was I was going to touch a nerve with this, because that's what I was hearing in all these conversations. And so I think the parties are going to say, yeah, we don't really like this, because, you know, depending on when one party comes to power at the right time or the other, they like the process of being able to help themselves.
So a practice, you're suggesting that a practice like gerrymandering has a historical precedent. I mean, both parties have indulged in gerrymandering in the past?
Yep, absolutely, and it's got a long history. And yeah, I would certainly say that each party does this when they get the chance, and that's part of what contributes to some of the less pleasant political dynamic is sometimes there's retribution, and so it's hard to give up something when you get it, and even there's a notion, I think, that, well, we don't have it now, but we might get it back someday, so we don't want to rain on this parade, but there are states that are doing this, California, Arizona, Washington, Iowa, and I think that it doesn't, you know, take the argument out of politics, but I think it makes for a better process when it comes to drawing these maps.
Sean, can you describe, even roughly, the ideally drawn district?
Square. That's the ideal.
Seriously?
Well, compact and square, yeah. I think that's...
contiguous.
Contiguous, no protection for incumbents, competitive, ideally. There's certainly dynamics of geography where you're not going to avoid seats that are very heavily populated by one party's member or the other. But there is a way to make a lot more seats more competitive so that... there's a chance at every election for folks to elect common sense folks from the middle, rather than a process that sort of rewards people who cater to the base of their parties and then never have to really work with the other side once they get elected.
I guess new U.S. Census data is what triggers this process. Do I have that right?
Absolutely.
So yeah. It's once a decade that happens. Short of that new data. Is there nothing that can lead to the redrawing of a district in between censuses? We just all wait for the census. Is that it?
Well, I guess I would offer some hope up. That's normally the case, but a mechanism that can be built into this is what's called a reset mechanism. So some of the states that have done it have said, okay, once this process goes into place, we're going to redraw the maps right away. Rather than wait for the next decade to roll around. So that's a mechanism that I would be interested in doing, particularly if this goes nowhere in the legislature and has to be done by a citizens referendum, then that's a factor that could be built in that says the people want this change now, and that's what's going to happen.
How long have you been a state rep, Sean?
I'm a seasoned member. I've been in the legislature almost 3 years.
Member of the old guard, is that it?
Second termers are you know, chairs of committees and all kinds of things.
What do you make of the discussion over term limits?
That's a great question. Thanks for asking that. I think term limits is sort of a knee-jerk reaction to the problem of gerrymandering, because I think that people got so frustrated with entrenched incumbents because these districts are drawn so safely to one party or the other that the idea of term limits came along and appealed to say, okay, well, let's get these entrenched folks out of here. Whereas if you had a competitive seat, you would probably have a lot more control over the office holder through the ballot box rather than having to use some artificial mechanism to get rid of them, good or bad people.
Gotcha. Democratic State Representative Sean McCann of Kalamazoo. We've been talking about his plan that would eliminate alleged gerrymandered districts in state legislative districts. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Summer is a busy time for archaeologists at Michigan State University. Construction projects on campus give them the opportunity to explore what's long been buried under the surface of the MSU campus. Joining us today to talk about what they're digging into this year are MSU Professor of Anthropology Lynn Goldstein and Katie Myers, an MSU graduate student who's serving and as a campus archaeologist this summer. Lynn and Katie, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you aboard. Sure, most of the work this summer is in the West Circle Drive area where there's lots of construction in front of the MSU Library and the Beale Gardens. What might you have been hoping you would turn up there, Lynn Goldstein?
Well, what we had hoped is that that area was used a lot during the history of MSU, and Professor Beale used the campus as his laboratory.
Yeah.
And he, at one point, got very annoyed about the fact that the river was, and sort of tributaries off it, were flooding his garden. So what he did is he rerouted the river. And the area that they're working in should be the location of where his altering the earth, let's say, took place. We know he did it, but we don't know how he did it or what exactly he did. So this gives us an opportunity to really explore that and to try to figure out what Beale actually did and potentially what effects it had.
Extraordinary. When would that have happened? When would Professor Beale have rerouted the Red Cedar River? Do you know?
I think it might have been... Katie, do you know the exact date?
It was 1884 was the first time that he started really changing the river.
Right, but he did it later also.
So he did this more than once.
He had to fix it.
Okay. Nature has a way of getting in the way of the best laid plans here, I guess. But how big of a project was this? How much of the river did he reroute? Do we know that, Lynn?
I don't think we know. Well, that's the point. We don't know exactly.
Okay.
We know that his goal was to make sure that his garden didn't flood.
Okay. And Katie Myers, what can you? How have you been involved in this project so far this summer?
Well, this summer I've been in charge of a team of graduate and undergraduate students that are actually working with the construction crews to excavate and mitigate these projects to make sure that they aren't disturbing anything archaeological, historical, prehistoric.
What is the role, if any, Lynn, of campus archaeology during a deconstruction project like the tearing down of Morrill Hall, which is now underway? Are you involved in that at all?
Well, we're involved in it only indirectly. I mean, because of safety concerns, you can't really have people running around while they're taking apart a building. But we've been photo documenting it, and one of the interesting things is that it is possible that there may be prehistoric sites on the place where Morrill Hall stands. So that's also another interest of ours. So we want to document the fact that this historic and important building is going down, and at the same time we also want to see if there's anything else that might be there.
And how late into the summer season, Katie Myers, how late into the season will you be working on the West Circle Drive area here this summer?
We'll be continuing to excavate and survey pretty much the entire summer. They don't actually finish the project until the end of August, right before school starts, so we'll be following with them.
And have you started or?
Yes, we actually started working with them in March when it was still frozen outside.
Okay.
So we've been following the construction throughout campus as it started since then.
And what do we know about what was at the area where you're digging? Was this the site of Professor Beale's residence or of his garden or what?
Currently, the site that we're looking at, there used to be a bridge there. So in between the library and the music practice building, there was a creek that Beale had filled in so that it wouldn't flood his gardens. And there used to be a bridge over that creek. So that's what we're trying to find is, how did he alter the land there? Can we find this bridge? Can we find how they filled it in?
How interesting. Lynn Goldstein, can you share some highlights of past digs on campus? I know you and I have spoken in the past, and a lot of this digging is focused on the north end of campus, which is where Michigan State University really, really started. What's been found so far?
Well, you know, we found a variety of different things that have been unexpected. And of course, that's an important part of archaeology. You know, people think that if something is written down, that becomes everything we know. And of course, what happens is people don't write everything down. it depends on the person, and they don't necessarily, if they think something is so common that everybody knows how to do it or what was done, they just don't write about it. So we find the information that people don't write about as well as things they do. So we found, for example, we found a prehistoric site that has never been documented across the street from the library. And that dates about 1500 to 3000 BC. We also found this little building last summer, which was a boiler house. MSU was expanding very rapidly, and they really didn't have the power in terms of heat and so on to keep up with the expansion. So that in the 1895, there were like four or five different heating systems, and there was a call to have it be coordinated. And that eventually happened in 1905. But between 1900 and 1905, they built Morrill Hall, and they also built the new dairy right near it. And so this little building was the boiler house to service those two new buildings. But then by 1905, this bigger coordinated center was put over by where the administration building is, and it was taken offline. So people forgot about it.
Katie Myers, you were good enough to bring in a tray full of artifacts here, probably two dozen things. We got an axe head. We've got all kinds of things. Anything in this tray from the prehistoric period that Lynn referred to, or is this all 19th century stuff?
We do. We have a few prehistoric points and some flakes that would have come off tools as they were being made that were found near Beaumont Tower.
We're also looking at an old knife that looks like it survived being underground for a long, long time. A lot of rusty-looking things, but we've got some post-industrial objects as well. We've got some bone. What appear to be bones here? What are those?
Yes, these are some animal bones, and what's interesting about them is that you can clearly see that they were butchered, and they were butchered by students, which we can tell because the butcher marks aren't that good. They're kind of learning how to do it.
Amateur evidence there. We've got a pipe here as well. Tell us about that. A small, what looks to be 19th century pipe.
Yeah, we actually find pipes a lot on the campus, which is interesting because they weren't allowed to smoke during the period that we find these pipes. So that's kind of an interesting thing about campus.
Is archaeology a part of the planning process, Lynn Goldstein, when a big dig is planned on campus? I know the project on West Circle Drive is an example, but lots of projects require digging.
Yes, they do. And our campus archaeology is part of that. So, for example, the work that is associated with EFRIB, in that regard, archaeology is legally required. But MSU has done a pretty extraordinary thing in supporting archaeology whenever they do any kind of ground disturbance. And that's extraordinary. Most places would never consider that.
And Katie Myers, quickly, what triggered your fascination with archaeology to the point where you wanted to study it in college?
I guess I just grew up with parents that were antique dealers, so I really fell in love with artifacts and the past, and this is a chance for me to find my own artifacts and help create the past or learn more about the past.
It is fascinating stuff. We thank you both for joining us. Katie Myers is an MSU graduate student who is serving as campus archaeologist this summer, and we also thank MSU professor of anthropology Lynn Goldstein. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Michigan faces a host of transportation issues. They're in the news every day. We get the take of Tim Fisher, Deputy Policy Director of the Michigan Environmental Council, on Michigan transportation issues coming up. Also, the City of Lansing's Director of Public Service, Chad Gamble, as we keep it subterranean here on Current State. Stay with us. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR. Current State, I'm Mark Bayshore. This Thursday, Lansing residents have a chance to weigh in on the latest suggestion for dealing with city sewage and stormwater. City administrators, including our next guest, say the so-called wet weather project would combine Lansing's 20-year-old CSO, most people know what that is, that's the Combined Sewage Overflow Project, along with two other similar projects involving sanitary sewer overflow and stormwater. Chad Gamble is the director of public service for the city, and he supports the wet weather project. He and others maintain the three initiatives can be successfully combined and would save taxpayers approximately $230 million. Welcome, Chad.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be here.
Good to have you back. As I understand it, the city has until 2020, that's seven more years, to complete the combined sewer overflow project. So other more recent mandates have triggered this wet weather idea? Is that it?
That's correct. The city initially, back in 1991, had been ordered by the DNR, now the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, to say, you must address the overflows to the river. We actually currently still discharge raw sewage to the river because our system was designed in that way. Back when the system was built, back in the 1930s, it was completely fine to discharge raw sewage to the river. This new regulation that was promulgated and passed in 1971 says you must begin to stop the wrongs of the past.
Right. And the two newer projects here, the two besides the CSO, those are unfunded?
Correct.
Okay. But if somehow, you're claiming if you combine the CSO project, which has been around for 20 years, with the other two, it can be done in a way that everything gets done and the city would save $230 million.
That's correct. What a lot of people don't understand, and nor would I expect them to, because it is highly technical. But what we're trying to do is these three separate programs are all really connected. In the end, they're all connected to the city's major infrastructure, all the big pipes that transport sewage and combined sewage, in essence, to the wastewater treatment plant. The DEQ had originally stated, well, you have the CSO program and you have to submit this project plan for that program, and the SSO program and you have to submit this plan for that program, and the small little stormwater program is only, you know, a couple million dollars and you have to submit this program. Well, in the end, we said, you know, this doesn't really make a lot of sense. Why the three separate plans when everything is all connected? You hear a lot of talk about watershed management, about looking at a more global perspective to our system. When we do that, and when we're leading the charge for the state of Michigan that says, you know, why don't we do that, and I bet you, as you've stated, we're going to save a lot more money, get the biggest bang for the taxpayers and ratepayers' buck, and also benefit the environment.
And what will this is all about? A cleaner environment, ostensibly. These are environmental initiatives, correct?
Absolutely. Our moniker for this is working towards a cleaner, greener Lansing. And remember, what we discharge to, in our essence, the Grand River, the Red Cedar River, flows downhill all the way to Lake Michigan. So we need to be environmental ombudsman for the environment, for our Great Lakes, but we also need to balance that with how cost-effective this is to our citizens. In our businesses.
Now, can you give us an example of how this cost-cutting scenario would play out? How is it you're able to save that much money?
Sure. One example is to kind of cherry-pick the low-hanging fruit of the requirements of the MDEQ, and let me try in a minute or two to explain that. For example, the DEQ says you must protect your system up to a 25-year, 24-hour storm event, which is approximately a 4-inch rain event. So if we have certain areas in the city that are susceptible to basement backups, for example,
right,
we can go in there and cherry pick maybe half a dozen or a dozen properties and protect them from basement backups, as opposed to upgrading the entire sanitary sewer system for the entire block.
I gotcha.
So
okay.
if we do it and do that in an incremental approach, in the end, it'll be better for the public health because we'll be able to do that immediately for people who have, you know, sewage backups in their basements. But also in the end, the ratepayers who have to support the entire system as far as the wet weather program.
We've had at least one spell of rainy weather this spring that risked flooding and overflows of sewage into fresh water. How bad does that get? And how much sewage flows into fresh water in a typical spring here in Lansing?
When we started the CSO program back in 19, 91, we discharged on average an annual of 1.7 billion gallons of combined sewage to the rivers. To date, we have reduced that number by approximately 950 million gallons. So it's roughly 600 million gallons on an average year that we discharge to the rivers. So basically every time it rains more than, you know, an appreciable amount, an eighth of an inch, we're still discharging raw sewage to the rivers. A lot of people don't understand that. And that's our program goal. That's what we were trying to do to better the environment for our children, to better the Great Lakes, for people to come and enjoy this Great Lakes state and turn over a better city for our children and their children.
Do you think Lansing residents are aware that that much sewage routinely still goes into the Grand River?
No, absolutely not. When I go to public meetings and I say this, and I somewhat dramatically say, do you know that there still is raw sewage being discharged to the rivers almost every time it rains? I get this blank stare like, no, really? You're kidding me, right?
Yeah.
And I say it again. I said, that's the program goals. That's why we need to spend this money for our children and to keep raw sewage from going in the rivers so we can enjoy these rivers. But the key thing is we must do it in a cost-effective way so as we can attract businesses, manufacturing to the region to make sure we're not the hole of the donut but the hub of the wheel.
You've been hanging around the mayor a while, I can tell that. Last month, City Council member Carol Wood was concerned about having money for this project, which suggests that there are still short-term costs to the wet weather project. Is this a short-term pain, long-term gain type situation?
Yes, we want to be able to throttle the expenditures in our program. You're used to, you know, rate increases from gas and power and electric water of, you know, 9, 10, 15%. What we've been doing with the sewage fund, which is the primary funding mechanism for the wet weather program, is to make sure that we're increasing the rates tactically, you know, 4 to 5%. To make sure that this is not too much of a burden on residents, on businesses, on industry, to make sure that we're attracting them, but also that we're doing what we need to as far as the environmental benefits of the program. It's part of what we'll call our triple bottom line approach. I know it sounds very governmentalish, but it looks at environmental issues, social issues, and economic issues, and tries to balance that three-legged stool so we're approaching them in a very methodical and logical way.
Have you taken the temperature of the City Council on this?
As a matter of fact,
do you have an idea where the council members stand on this?
Yes. As a matter of fact, last night we presented this program to them again. We've been doing that over the past couple of years and letting them know that we're working on this, and they passed unanimously the support of the first 5 years of the wet weather control program. So we're very happy that we got unanimous support of that, and we're looking forward to working with the council, working with the residents on this great environmental project.
Are people disagreeing with you about the savings that you claim? You're claiming $230 million worth of savings. Is there any hesitation to accept that figure?
Well, certainly there's a lot of questions because it is such a large number.
Yeah.
And we can show people this large binder that I brought that details some of those cost savings. But yes, it is a big number, and we are very proud of all the efforts that we've been studying over the past couple of years on how that we can maximize our benefits to the environment, but also minimize the cost to the ratepayers.
How important is it from a public health or environmental standpoint to ensure that this project does get completed?
Well, there's a couple of different points there. One, this program, the way it's been presented to the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, has never been presented this way. We've never taken approach to all the three unfunded federal mandates of the Clean Water Act, CSO, SSO, and Stormwater, and approach them in this way. We want to work collaboratively with the MDQ, which we have been. They've been great partners working through this whole project and saying, you know, this is something brand new, and want to take them kind of out of their box and do something great for the environment. So it is very important for us as a team to be successful.
Nobody in Michigan has proposed this.
Correct.
Okay. Very interesting.
Yeah.
And City Council would have to approve it, and DEQ would have to approve it.
Correct.
Okay. The idea has been out there for a little while, as you said. The State Journal and Channel 10 have both covered it. An LSJ editorial claimed it would save While the editorial claimed it would save over $300 million, has it triggered many phone calls or emails to your office?
You know, it has not triggered a lot of phone calls. I think that that number, the complexities of the system, it really is difficult for a lot of people to get a handle on. That's why it's so important for us to be able to educate them, like shows exactly like this, public hearings and other meetings that we will have in the future about the importance of this program and how it benefits everyone really in the region and in the state.
I know spreading the costs out over decades is a fiscal advantage, but can the city function safely for decades until these projects are finished?
Yes, we have been functioning this way ever since the city was built. You know, before the wastewater treatment plant was built in the 1930s, we just discharged sewage to the river. You know, the solution to pollution was dilution. You know, you just send it to the river and it'll go downstream and everything will be fine.
You begin to wonder how the river has survived this over all these years.
You really do. And you look at Lake Michigan and the challenges that it has, and then you start putting these things together. And then people start to understand how it's so challenged to stay as healthy as it has and what we need to continue to do working with us and all the communities that are attached to the river and making a better Great Lakes, a better Grand River, and a better community for us to live in.
Very good. Chad Gamble is the Director of Public Service for the City of Lansing. We've been talking about the Wet Weather Project. Chad, good to see you.
Great to see you, too.
State on 90.5 WKAR, there's no shortage of transportation issues to discuss in Michigan. After 40 years and 23 attempts, Metro Detroit finally has a regional transportation authority. At the top of Governor Snyder's agenda is a new road funding bill. But will the legislature provide the funds he says he needs to make the necessary improvements? And here in mid-Michigan, the debate still simmers around whether to approve a $600,000 federal grant to expand Michigan Flyer bus service. Here to help us sort out some of Michigan's most pressing transportation issues is Tim Fisher. Tim's the Deputy Policy Director at the Michigan Environmental Council and specializes in transportation infrastructure. Welcome to Current State, Tim.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
What is the impact here of the Regional Transportation Authority in Detroit? What does it mean that it finally has this?
Yeah, the Regional Transit Authority for Metro Detroit, it's a significant first step. And as you mentioned, in 23 attempts over, four decades, we finally have this in place. It's really more of an administrative or a coordinative body. It'll coordinate transit service for the providers in the Detroit metropolitan area. It'll be the recipient for federal and state funds. It'll have the ability to force coordination that will, ideally provide a higher level of coordinated service for the passengers.
And why is that? Why was Detroit so long in organizing an RTA? Michigan, I should say.
Yes, in Southeast Michigan, we've been plagued by, balkanization of the whole region. I think one of, certainly one of the factors is race. It's a very segregated area. There's a mistrust. And so these sorts of regional authorities are very difficult to work through those barriers. But this is really a bright spot from last legislative session, and we think it's a great foundation from which to build.
What are some of the major projects that an RTA would likely address?
Well, the first thing that the RTA will do, it's up and running now. It's almost 6 months old at this point. So what they're doing at this point is they're figuring out how they're going to work. The board is appointed from the counties and the city, so there are two members from each of the counties and one from Detroit. They will look at the regional transit plan, see if they need to be updated, how they need to be updated, if they'll look at different service, such as bus rapid transit. They might look at the possibility of light rail in the region as well. So these are things that will be part of their inquiry, but there's a lot of work yet to do to get to that point.
Now, explain for us what the role the state legislature plays here. I guess opt-outs are being discussed. What's the impact of that?
Yeah, as I mentioned, that the RTA is almost 6 months old, and already we've seen two attempts in the legislature to start hacking away at the RTA. One, as you mentioned, it's a bill in the House, and that would allow communities within the four counties to opt out of participation within the RTA. What this does is it creates a checkerboard kind of pattern of transit service, making it very difficult to provide transit service based on demand. And it creates inefficiencies that builds inefficiencies directly into the system, making it more expensive and less feasible for passengers to take the transit system.
Is this evidence that the balkanization of Southeast Michigan is alive and well?
Well, it certainly is. It's one thing that we need to do when we're looking at regional approaches to issues is to understand that the region benefits when all communities are strong and thriving. This is but one key component of successful regions is a coordinated transit service.
How concerned are you over the longer haul about the effectiveness of an RTA, given the resistance that sprung up?
There's a lot of work to do to protect the RTA as it is currently configured and to make sure that it has the tools and the funding needed to operate a successful system. So we'll be constantly vigilant to make sure that it has what it needs to be successful.
Are proponents like you, though, creating more believers? Do you feel you're creating more supporters?
I'm not sure that at this point we're creating more supporters. I think what will create more supporters is once the RTA is operating, is coordinating routes, hacking out inefficiencies, and providing a higher level of coordinated service. Once people see that that they can go from point A to point B, very very quickly. And safely on the transit systems, then that will the success of those trips will create more believers.
What about the impact on our listeners here in mid Michigan? What's their investment in this?
Well, their investment and indeed for the state as a whole that these transit systems are supported through state transportation dollars.
And is there a payoff for our listeners here in mid-Michigan to this?
Well, there certainly is. There are kind of two direct payoffs. One is that we all have an interest in ensuring that our tax money is spent wisely and efficiently. This RTA will help ensure that.
And how exactly?
By eliminating redundancies in the transit systems, by coordinating the various transit routes. And also visitors to the region will be able to benefit from a well-coordinated and successful transit system. So if you want to take in a Tigers game or one of the festivals downtown, you will directly benefit by being able to ride a safe, affordable transit system to get you around to these events.
We're talking with Tim Fisher of the Michigan Environmental Council about transportation issues here in Michigan. Let's move to the road funding debate. WKAR reported earlier today On House Transportation Committee Chairman Wayne Schmidt of Traverse City. He says high gas prices threaten to stall talks over boosting the funding for Michigan roads. Lawmakers recently added $350 million in one-time spending for roads in the state budgets. But Schmidt says he's committed to finding a permanent funding solution before lawmakers leave for a two-month break.
You know, it'd be easy just to say, well, we found that $350 million. It's one-time monies. Let's go home for the summer. That's not quite what I'd like to do.
Does that encourage you?
Yeah, Chairman Schmidt has been a real leader on this issue. He has been holding hearings over the past few weeks about looking at specific proposals to, you know, increase our transportation funds. I'm, you know, have been encouraged by his leadership and his, you know, and his working on this issue. At some point, you know, this needs to go beyond the discussion point, and I think that he is trying to do that. He is looking for votes on a couple of the bills that he's sponsored or is promoting. And just in about a half an hour, the House Transportation Committee will meet to discuss some of these proposals.
The governor says he would like $1.2 billion for that. This will that cover it in your view?
That is a start. There have been a whole series of
just a start.
It is a start. We have underfunded our transportation system for many years at this point. So there are real costs that are closer to $3 billion, according to some studies that came out just a few years ago.
Are you more inclined to go for that higher figure than the governor's 1.2?
Yeah, it depends on what we're spending the money on. 1.2 is a start, and that will be a good start for maintaining the system that we have, as well as putting some well-needed funds into our transit system and passenger rail system. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the real price tag is considerably higher.
That's doing nothing. Well, doing nothing carries quite a price tag, too, according to the governor.
Well, and he's dead on at that point. You know, it's expensive to fix your roof on your house that is leaking. However, the alternative is to let your house rot away, and that's considerably a more expensive proposition.
If substantial funding for road improvement doesn't make this budget, what's next?
Well, it has not made the budget. So the budgets have been through. This money would be in the form of a supplemental supplemental funds after the this fiscal year. So the budget that's been in place that has passed is just a status quo budget. This $1.2 billion would be in addition to what the legislature has passed already.
Very good. Tim Fisher is the Deputy Policy Director at the Michigan Environmental Council. Tim, thank you for joining us today to discuss transportation issues in Michigan.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we look at how federal funding will affect the Ingham County Health Plan. Also, Neighbors in Action features Black Man Incorporated of Greater Lansing. And we'll also talk with an explorer who recently discovered a shipwreck at the bottom of Lake Michigan. We'll have all of that and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry and Aaron Young for engineering. Also, Andy Curtis, thanks for your production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Thank you.
Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, hosting the annual Grub Crawl on Tuesday, June 11th, starting at 5 in the Eastwood Town Center. Details and wristbands available at lansingchamber.org. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.